Session number 13518, wheel number 1.
Mr. Martin, reel 1. You were telling me that you come from a long line of policemen.
I would rather say a police force family. Yes, well, I've had my father's uncles, cousins, etc., right through. So I wouldn't say a long line of police because police forces haven't been in existence all that long.
Which part of the country do you come from?
Kent.
Which part?
Mid-Kent. Mid-Kent.
Maidstone?
Yeah, near Maidstone.
Did you go to school in Maidstone?
I did. Yes, I went to Maidstone Technical College. Yeah.
How old were you when you left school?
16.
So that was in 1930?
Yes, that's right.
Did you then get a job?
I did, yes. I worked at Coxheath, a Coxheath Institution then, as it was called.
What was that?
It was the old workhouse. You know, the old workhouse was changed from workhouse to Poor Law Institution, and then to Public Assistance Institution, and now later it has now become sort of among the old county hospitals. But that's Coxheath, about 4 miles outside Maidstone on the Linton Road.
But in 1936 you decided to go in for the Palestine Police.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Oh, well, that, I regard myself very lucky in that respect, really, to have gone to Palestine, because I remember just reading an article that said Britain polices the world, and it was illustrated with a photograph of a policeman on the Wailing Wall at Jerusalem, and then it went on to say that there was the British police in Palestine, the Palestine Police Force, and all the other various colonial forces throughout the world in the old British Empire. And it went on to illustrate that these police forces were all sort of manned and controlled by people from England. When this advertisement appeared in the paper a little while after for recruits for the Palestine Police Force, and I had just read this article, I thought this would just suit me down to the ground. So I applied, and I went up to London where I was interviewed at the Crown Agents, and having passed a medical examination, I was accepted. And I sailed on the 13th of March, 1936, for Palestine.
Where had the article appeared?
It was in John Bull, I think, the old weekly paper, John Bull. That's where I'd read this article of Britain polices the world, but the advertisement for Palestine Police was in the Daily Telegraph.
What did they want to know at the interview?
Oh, I just wanted to know your education, you know, and your standard of education right through. You needed to have, if you were from the military, you needed to have a first class education certificate. But from civilian life, a secondary school education was sufficient, and that's the category that I was accepted in, as my education was secondary school education, and that was sufficient to get in.
What kind of career prospects did they offer you on joining?
Well, it was pointed out then, when I joined, that one must not have any colour bar in one's mind, sort of thing. And it may very, very likely be that you'd be stationed in some area where you might have an Arab senior officer or a Jewish senior officer in the station. But more likely than not, it would be a British one. But you had to accept the fact that if an Arab or a Jew was senior to you, then it was up to you to obey the instructions and orders that you would get from such a chap.
Did you feel happy about that?
I did, yes. No, in those days I had no colour prejudices at all. And I don't today, really.
What was the voyage like? Did you travel with others who had been recruited?
Yeah, 20 of us. 20 of us went to Palestine. We sailed on the Rajputana on the 13th of March. And it was a Friday, the 13th. And I just wondered then, what does this mean, sailing away on an unlucky day like this? But it turned out to be a very lucky day for me.
What impressions of Palestine did you get on arrival?
When we arrived at Jerusalem Railway Station, we were met by two vans, Morris vans. One was to take our luggage, and the other one the personnel we crept in. And the one we were in was covered with wire mesh. And someone asked a question of the driver, "What's this?" He said, "Like a chicken house." He said, "Oh no," he said, "this is to keep the bombs off." In case the bombs, he said, these quite often happen. He said, and some of the terrorists in the past have got rather clever too. They've been attaching hooks to bombs and throwing them so the hooks would catch into the wire and explode on the top. He said, so if one does land, he said, make sure you unhook it and let it slip off. So one a friend of mine who was in this squad called Jelasix, I can remember, he looked at me and he said, what the bloody hell have we let ourselves in for here?
Had you not been mentally prepared for that type of thing?
Not really, not to that extent, because there had been one or two little flare-ups in Palestine, but it wasn't so widespread. These risings had taken place and had lasted for two or three days, you know, and then they died down. And at the time that we went, it was all quiet, and there hadn't been any real serious trouble in Palestine since 1933. You see, there had been about 3 years with it all quite quiet. So when we went, we weren't anticipating that we're having anything like this.
How much about the political situation in Palestine had you known before you went?
Very little. Very, very little indeed. Very little. I had seen on one of these news reels that you've seen at the cinema, a little feature on Palestine, sort of thing, and it was talking there and illustrating the way the Jews had arrived and had built up a lot of Jerusalem, and it all looked very, very modern and peaceful and quiet, and it didn't seem that likely there would be any trouble at all. And when I arrived, it was quite peaceful and quiet. And on the first Sunday, I remember going for a walk right up from Mount Scopus, from the camp we were, up onto the Mount of Olives, and looking down over the Jordan Valley, seeing the Dead Sea, about 40 kilos away in the bottom there. A lovely sight it was. And it all seemed so peaceful. And Arabs walking along there were saying, Sayyida, Sayyida, you know, good day, as you went by. And then we started our training. But we hadn't been training for more than 2 days. And we were sent down to Jerusalem, to the town, to be billeted at police headquarters to augment the police in Jerusalem for the Easter feasts, because they had Easter feasts arrived. The Feast of Nebi Musa was the Muslims' feast, and then the Passover for the Jews came about the same time, and the Easter feasts, they all came very, very close on, you know, almost on one on top of the other. And it was said that the Nebi Musa, the Muslim feasts, was something that had really been originated by the Turks, so that they would have in Jerusalem a large body of Muslims to offset the large crowds of Jews and Christians that gathered at Jerusalem over the Easter period. I think the Jewish feast at that time was Passover, I think that coincided with the Christian Easter. And then the Turkish authorities then had felt that either the Jews might rebel or the Christians might rebel, and they would be hard put to keep it in control. So this feast of the prophet Moses, Nebi Musa, that was instituted to bring a big crowd of Muslims into Jerusalem at the same time, so that they could be relied on to offset any rising by either Christians or Jews. Well, we went down to Jerusalem, and it was a most monotonous job, really, because huge crowds of Arabs came in from all the surrounding towns and districts, and they collected and formed processions to go right down through the old city of Jerusalem from the Jaffa Gate area down to the mosque, the Haram al-Sharif, the big mosque of Omar, right down at the bottom. And they went down very, very slowly, just walking a few steps along the road and then stopping and dancing and singing. And young men were doing a sword dance where, you know, one sat on another one's shoulders and he ran around and waved his sword, and all the people around were singing and dancing. And this went on for a few minutes there, and then they moved another few feet and we went on. So I suppose this carried all the way from the top of David Street right down through the whole of the bit through what they called Al Wad area, and then I think it must be the Via Dolorosa, down the Via Dolorosa towards St. Stephen's Gate and down to the mosque itself. Now you can imagine this whole area, I should think, wouldn't be more than 3/4 of a mile, might even be less than 3/4 of a mile. And it took about 4 hours to do it. And in the heat of the day, we were set off in sections between the various crowds to stop the Hebron people fighting with the Nablus people and so on, you see. The various other sections came from Jaffa and then Bethlehem.
Why should the Hebron and Nablus people have fought with each other?
Just because there's a little bit of enmity between all these people. And I can remember that they were crying out this time, the Nablus people, I think it was, were crying out to the Hebronites, "You haven't tasted blood this year." They were singing this, "You haven't tasted blood this year. What are you, a lot of sheep in your area," sort of thing, because they had stopped some visitors travelling up through their area, I think, and had robbed and shot and killed a few, so they felt that they were They were the bloodthirsty warriors and the others who hadn't done anything that year, so they were needling each other like that. So that is the reason that we were interspersed between all these various sections to keep one away from the other.
How could
rather in the way that the Metropolitan Police do today. You see, when you get these demonstrations taking part, the police march in between the demonstrators and the anti-demonstrators sort of thing, just to keep them apart. It was rather similar sort of thing to that.
Could you tell the Nablus people from the Hebronites?
You could do, yeah. You know, we, being recruits, I mean, we had to have these sort of things pointed out to us. But the old coppers who had been there for years, they could recognise them from the way they dress. Particularly the Hebronites used to wear orange-coloured turbans. That would set them off against the Nablus people that wore the hatta and nagal sort of thing.
What was that?
That's that rather like Arafat wears, you know. What's his name?
The checked.
The checked
headdress.
The check. That's the hatta. A hatta and the agal is the black rope that goes round the top. Then I've forgotten his name. Yasser Arafat. That's his name. Yes, that's right. That's his trademark now. That thing. Apparently, the way he doubles it up and fixes it, it hangs down and it forms a map of Palestine. So I was told. Well, this went on, and we had this business of Nabi Musa business going round to the mosque. Then after they go into the mosque, then they all went down to Jericho. All they loaded into buses, you know, big convoy buses. They all went down to Jericho because Jericho was supposed to be where Musa's tomb was when Moses had come with the children of Israel, sort of thing, wandering through the desert and seen the promised land, and then he died down there. He wasn't allowed to enter, according to the biblical writings. If you remember, he died before he was able to go in, but God gave him the promise of seeing it, and so on. And over the other side, somewhere in that particular locality of the Jordan Valley, that is where Musa's tomb, Moses' tomb, was supposed to be. So they went down there and they did 2 or 3 days fasting, praying, and then feasting, and then having a few games of horse racing, which they loved to do, galloping around with their horses, racing one against the other. And then back they came after this 3 or 4 days down there, and we had the old business again of getting them all into Jerusalem, down to the mosque, and then from the mosque up, and loading up onto their lorries and sending them off. And eventually they all left and went away to their various districts. And one senior officer, I remember saying to a comrade of his, "Thank God that's all over for another year."
So nothing serious happened?
Nothing serious happened. No, that was all quiet. And then I think the next thing I had to do was go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to take part in what they call the Ceremony of the Holy Fire. This was a Christian affair. When the light seems to come through onto the holy tomb, which symbolizes the rising of Christ after he'd been placed in the tomb and then he'd risen from the dead, and the light from heaven has shone down with the resurrection of Jesus, sort of thing. And inside the tomb there would have been a monk or priest of some sort who, by some little subterfuge, would manage to strike a match and say, "This is the Holy Father that's come down from heaven," sort of thing. They used to wait until the sun shone through a hole in the roof, and when the sun shone through the hole in the roof, so this is the thing. So he would start this light and come out with burning candles, and then all the people who were so fervently waiting for him, trying to get their candles lit from this holy fire which had come from the tomb. And then you would find mamas taking a little bit of candle grease and sort of putting a little cross on their children's foreheads and so on. And I was just amused, really, when I thought of it. First of all, I was quite shocked, really, because where I was standing, trying to keep one section away from another, keeping away, probably Armenians keeping away, Armenians from Copts or something, or one group from the other. I was getting pushed and shoved around a little bit, but I didn't really take too much notice about it, because I could see they were all terribly excited, and that was, I could manage to sort of keep them aside so they didn't start fighting and squabbling among themselves. That was all right. But there was one dear old fellow called Inspector Black who just walked up, and he saw that I was having a little bit of trouble like this, and he reached over and he grabbed one of these Christian Arabs who'd been pushing me about a bit badly, and he clobbered him a real fourpenny one, and he said, "Take that, you bastard, I'll teach you to push my British policeman around." And I was really much amused, and I thought, oh dear, is this holy of holy places sort of thing. Bill Black, he says, "Take that, you bastard." And I thought it was rather amusing just there at that time. But then this Easter business was all finished. We didn't have much to do, the Jews, with their Passover feast. They were all carried out quite quietly, without any untoward police activity. We went back then to resume our training at Mount Scopus, back from police headquarters, because we'd spent all our time then doing this various work. Auxiliary work for the police that were there. And we just got back and we started doing 2 days training, and down in Jaffa, riots, real riots broke up there, where the Arabs had risen once more and demonstrated against this Jewish immigration.
Which month might this have been?
This was middle of April, I think. Must have been middle of April, because I got there on the 25th of March, and I had a fortnight down in Jerusalem headquarters. So it must have been just about the middle of April. Then we were sent down to Jaffa, to reinforce the various police down there. Quite a few Jews had been killed, and a few houses had been burnt out that were bordering on the, in what they called the Manshia area, which was where the Arab part joined on to the Jewish part of Tel Aviv. And we had to patrol and keep that quiet there and make sure that no more crowds came in. But I was only there for about 4 days, and I was sent back to Jerusalem. And then...
How ugly was that rioting?
Very, very, very bad indeed it was. Very bad. But I didn't see the worst of it. The worst of it had happened before we got there. We were there for about 4 days, just patrolling, when it had died down. I can't think quite how many. I know that a few people had been shot by the police. And a camel corps had been called in, not with their camels, of course. They'd come up dismounted. The Bedouins were very reliable. The Bedouins were in the camel corps. They were very reliable sort of chaps. And they'd come up and help to quell the riots up there. But then we went back to continue our training. But by then, the whole of the country had blown up into a riotous situation, you know. And right up in the north, all along the Israelian and Jezreel valleys, Jewish settlements had been attacked by armed gangs of Arabs. The Transjordan Frontier Force had been called in to help, and we had to go up every day from Jerusalem. We went up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon up to Afuli, and then patrolled all around those settlements during the evening and late until midnight, and then get back to Afuli and collect two milk lorries that had got all their milk churns on to go to Jerusalem. We escort these things back to Jerusalem. So that was a job that we were doing quite regularly then. And in between doing this, we'd get a few odd lectures and drill parades and things like that, part of training. But I'm afraid my training was very, very much curtailed with all these events. And after about 2 months, one day, I was told with the rest of our squad that were present at the depot at that time, to get our kit all ready and packed because we were going to Tulkarm, because there was real trouble in Tulkarm where an Arab policeman had been shot accidentally by a British policeman. And the Arab police were all mutinying about this because they wouldn't accept that this was an accident, and they thought it was deliberately done. So away we went to Tulkarm, and I can remember getting on the tender with my rifle, and my kit was all loaded on. And up till then, I'd only been trained in the use of a greener gun, but not an SMLE rifle, but a greener gun. And when we got on there, we each had about 50 rounds of ammunition in our rifle. And the inspector that was sending us off, he said, "Well, you better load your rifles, because you never know, you might want them on the way." So one or two perhaps who understood, they loaded their rifles, but quite frankly, I didn't know how to load my rifle. I'd never been trained in the use of this SMLE rifle at all. So when I did put in a clip of ammunition, and of course instead of keeping it all in the magazine without being known, I closed the bolt, I had one up the spout. I thought, well, this isn't quite right. So the inspector said to me, "Hang on a minute." He took the rifle off me and just showed me how to do it. Putting your thumb on the top and pressing them down and pressing the bolt over the top. But that just illustrates how scanty